So I'm kind of running out of ideas about what to talk about, to be honest. But I thought tonight we could talk about non-minyan coronavirus halacha. We've heard enough about minyanim on the mirpeset, in the backyards, across the street, intercity, across the world, on the moon. Enough, enough, enough. No more minyan questions. Let's talk about other things that came up during this epidemic, besides for minyan. So I have a few issues, some big, some small. We'll start with one big one, all right? Then we'll go through some small ones, and then we'll go back to the big ones. So one big one, which affected many people, especially people with children of all ages, is what to do with tuition during these times, right? There was a whole time period where the kids didn't have school at all and didn't have gun. And then there was time when they went back to school, but it was remote, right? Which included, you know, not paying for meals, right? If you were paying for meals, or not paying for a hasa'a, if you were paying for a hasa'a, and things like that. And in general, you know, what happens when the kids stop school early or stop school in the middle for a certain amount of time. So what do we do? Should the schools give back the tuition if it's already been paid? Should the parents just be mevater and be mochel and say, no, the tuition is paid already. I'm not gonna take it back. And the question that we haven't struck yet is what happens next year? Do prices change next year, or should things be any different if things are going to continue the way that they are? Anybody want to chime in before we even get started with any of the sources? Any thoughts?
Is it a contractual question?
Certainly these same issues can come up in non-school settings. If, you know, you were hired to do a job, that's kind of where we're going to go with this in many cases. If you were hired to do a job and then were unable to do the job, or the job was no longer relevant or something like that, it's the same issue. But in our particular case, I think the most widespread question came from schools. All right, so let's jump in. The truth is that there's so much to do, I don't really want to read the Gemaras inside. I can tell you outside that there's two main Gemaras over here, Bava Metzia, Daf Ein Vav Amud Bet, and Daf Kuf Hey Amud Bet, which both deal with a question that basically, you know, along the lines of what Barbara was talking about, not from a school perspective, the Gemara really doesn't have much to say about that, but actually from a worker-employer perspective. Specifically, if you owned a field and you hired laborers to do work on the field, and then all of a sudden something terrible happened. There was a you know, an act of God type of disaster, whether it was a flood, whether it was a drought, or some kind of disease or something like that, which caused, you know, it was impossible for the worker. There was no point in the workers doing their work. So now what happens? Do the workers still get paid for their work, or do they not? And the Gemara seems to basically make it come down to a question of whether or not it was to be expected. Namely, by the way, I'm for most of the sources for this section, I'm actually taking from Rabbi Gil's student's blog, TorahMusings.com. It's a very good blog for all things. But in particular, he had a nice write-up for most of this issue, which I used. I used other sources as well. But, you know, he summarizes the Gemaras quite nicely by saying that basically, if it's an ones is a, you know, something that happened that was out of your control. If it was an ones that the owner should have anticipated, he should have expected it, then he has to pay the workers. If it's something that the workers themselves should have anticipated, then they're going to lose. And if nobody could have anticipated it, you know, aliens came down and blew up all of the fields or something. So then what happens? The workers lose. Why do the workers lose? Because there's an assumption here. The workers don't really lose. The workers lose because of the way that payment was done in those days, which is that when you finish the work, you get paid, right? So what you have here is a classic case of what's called Hamotzi Mechavero, Alav Haraya. If you want to extract money from somebody, then you need to prove that they owe you that money. And in this case, the owner can say, look, you know, nobody could have expected this. I didn't expect this. You didn't expect this. So I'm not going to pay you because something happened that nobody was going to be able to expect. However, of course, what does that mean? If the whole rule is predicated on hamotzi mechavero alaf haraya, that whoever has the money keeps the money, then what does that mean? That means that what happens if the owner had already paid the workers before they did the work? Presumably.
Sounds like the workers are in a stronger position then.
Yeah, it would seem that in that case, the workers would be in a stronger position. This is, of course, going to be very relevant for us and for our particular question. When you go into the early Achronim, you see that Mairam Padua, 16th century Italy, okay, shortly before the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah were written, the Mairam Padua dealt with this question. He was asked this. Right, so there was apparently a plague in Venice in the 16th century. You learn something every day. And the Talmud, in this case, a Talmud ran away. He ran away from the city and he couldn't go to his tutor anymore. Right, he couldn't be taught anymore. So now, does the father of the Talmud have to pay the Malamed? The Malamed was expecting a student and his student ran away. The Malamed seems to clearly still be in the city. He's still in Venice. The student's the one who ran for the hills. He went to summer camp early because he was scared of the magifa. Who wins? Does the teacher get paid or does he not get paid? So the Mairam Padua writes, "Hello, ahovi devar pashutu v'halacha revacha b'Yisrael miperek ha'umnim shekol onsa demikri lamelamed opolim levatalam mimlacha v'lo ibay lasuk yadaitu shel polo v'shel ba'al habayit." Bottom line, he says, if you have a situation where the onus was unforeseeable both to the worker and to the employer, in this case, the Baal HaBayit is the father, the poel is the melamed, in that case, the poel is the one who loses because he can't extract the money from the Baal HaBayit. So if he hasn't yet been paid, the teacher, nothing he can do. No recourse. V'nomar shamazal ha'poel b'gorim. Basically say over here, tough luck for the poel. V'nidon didan, domem ha'ash l'ha d'zeh shabarach me'emat ha'negev, yikarei ones b'vaday v'shneem shavim b'yidi ha'melamed v'atamen. It seems to be that that's how we should apply to this case. Nobody expected the Spanish Inquisition and nobody expected the magefa in Venice. Nobody expected it. And so who loses? The Malamed loses. Now he says, though, lo svir li lechanot nidon didan makat medina. V'chichol adarim bevenetzia barchu v'nitbatu mimuyudam. He says, however, there is a second category. And this is where the Mairam Padua has a chiddush. There's a second category called makat medina. It's not his chiddush, it's based on the Gemara. Makat medina is when everybody is affected. Everybody was affected by the whatever happened, whether it was a drought, whether it was a sickness, whatever it was. Because he says, Halo miuta de miuta barchu. He says, the truth is, when you look in this case, from what I heard in Venice, only a few people ran away. V'dome mamash lepsik nara bepalga diome. It's like a case where water stopped in the middle of the day. That's what it literally means. And basically, some people have access to water and some people don't. He says, V'afilu hachi amin and shan. Okay, so he says, says, what's a makat medina? A makat medina is a case where there was some kind of disaster that affected everyone equally. Everyone in the city, in the country, everyone is affected. And that would be called a makat medina. And in a makat medina, the halacha is different. The halacha is that the poel gets paid. Says, what's an example? Says, if the gzerat hamoshel shaloyim medua talmidim shekulam b'teilim. If, let's say, you hired a tutor, and then the government came out with a ruling that said students are not allowed to learn in school anymore. In those cases, the teacher gets paid. V'im lachshoch adam lomar me'achar shenidon zeh eino makan medina shelo baruchu kulam rak amiot im ken lo yikra ones. So then they say, wait a second though, I don't understand. If it's not a makat medina, then why did the Talmud run away? If it's not so dangerous, so why did the Talmud run away? And his running away should be basically seen as an act of negligence, and the teacher should be paid. He says, no, you can't say that. He said, because the truth is that people who actually are scared of sicknesses are the ones who are most likely to be affected by those sicknesses. So you can't criticize or accuse the student of being paranoid or anything like that. He legitimately ran away. And unfortunately, in this case, the Malamed has to forfeit his salary. So what did we learn? What did we learn from this piece? Let's break it down. What did we learn from this piece in the Maran Padua? We learned several things. Give me Tamtit a little bit. Jake, name some things that we learned from this piece. Let's see what does he say the halacha is in his specific case? Student ran away. He ran for the Catskills because there was going to be a epidemic in his city. So he ran away, leaving the teacher with no one to teach. Does the teacher get paid in this case?
It seems yes.
The Maran Padua says in this case, the teacher does not get paid.
He was justified in running away.
That's the last point he makes, is that he was justified, and because it's not considered a makat medina, and since nobody could have expected it, it follows the basic halacha of when nobody expects it, hamotzi mechavero alav haraya, you can't extract the money from the father. The assumption here is that the father has not yet paid the melamed. So you can't extract the money from the father because he didn't expect it, nobody expected it, and the money's still in the hands of the father, and as Barbara pointed out, he was totally legitimate in running away. The one wrinkle that the Maran Padua added was this idea of makat medina. If it would be really an epidemic, or if it was some kind of case where everybody was equally affected, such as if the government said that nobody's allowed to go to school, nobody's allowed to learn, then the halacha would reverse and the teacher would get paid. The po'el would get paid in a makat medina. Because a makat medina gives the upper hand to the po'el, to the worker. That's based on the second Gemara in Bava Metzia that we didn't look at. Is that clear to everybody what the Maran Padua is saying? If we were to stop here, what would he say for the halakha for Corona?
The worker gets paid.
Why?
Because it's pretty much across the board.
It's across the board.
I don't know if that's true because not everyone's impacted the same way. You only have 20% of the population that's out of work, which only 20%. But it's not 80%. It's not 100% of
the population. Right. Well, we're talking about the schools specifically now. Talking about, if the government says no kids are allowed to go to school anymore, and let's say there was no distance learning. Government says no kids are going to be allowed to go to school. No, all the teachers are paid leave. They don't do anything.
Learning.
What?
It's not hypothetical. There was no distance learning.
For a certain period of time, there was no distance learning. You're right. For a certain period of time, there was no distance learning. And especially for things like ganim, where there's no such thing as distance learning, right? Mm-hmm. You're basically paying gananot to be kind of like babysitters that also teach a little bit, right? That's basically what they are. And they're not getting that that benefit. So should they get paid? So if the government said, you're not allowed to do it, it's illegal, it would seem from Maran Padua that would be a makat medina and that the teachers should get paid, even though they're staying batel. By the way, Dad, separately and apropos of nothing, I was listening to a podcast. I have to ask you after this about a rubber room. Have you ever heard of rubber rooms for teachers?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about that after. Remind me. So
rubber rooms for teachers, you're saying, right?
Yes. Okay, so anyways, yes. It would seem from the Maran Padua that in the case of Makat Medina, at least the gananot should get paid. Everybody should get paid. Whatever the government said should happen. How does this come down the halakha? So the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, quotes the Maran Padua. He says, "V'chein pasak Maram al melamed shegazar hamoshel shelo yomod." He brings both sides. "Dehavei makan medina v'kol hafsed al balabait." This is actually, kind of an oversimplification. Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. This Maharam is not the Maharam Padua. This is the Maharam Mirottenberg. It's actually confusing. There's two Maharams. So he says, the Maharam Mirottenberg says that if the Moshel is Gozer Shelo Yulmod, then it's a Makan Medina, and the Hefsed is on the Balabayit, and the Poel gets paid. This is actually what the Maharam Padua was quoting. I know it's confusing. There's two Maharams. There's the Maharam Mirottenberg, Ashkenazi Posek, Ashkenazi Rishon, Major Rishon from the, I want to say 13th century, the time of the Mordechai and the Rush. He was actually the Rebbe of the Rush. And then there's the Maharam Padua, who was an Italian rabbi in the 16th century, who was quoting and channeling the Maharam Mirottenberg, who they both say that if it's a widespread Makat Medina, so then the Poel has the upper hand. V'yesh Cholkin, the Rama says, but there are those who disagree. V'sviru lu demikanu laba b'din chazarakai, k'mon d'amin le'el. V'im lo chazar iu da'avse anavshe yomachal. Okay. But in the end, he says, asvar harishona nira li ikar. He says he agrees with the Maharam Mirottenberg. The Rama agrees, Makat Medina, the Poel gets paid. The teacher would get paid. Now, there is a massive machlokas about this. The Sma is on one side, the Shach on the other, the Nesivas HaMishpat joins in as well, but the majority view appears to be like the Rama, like the Maharam Padua, that if it's a Makat Medina, that the payment goes to the Poel. The Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michael Epstein, sheds a little bit of light on this, and he says, Im nitava ba'ir shinoy avir, ubarchu, havu kishar onis, v'havi pseida de poel o hamalamed. So he says, if stam, something happens in the city and many people run away, so in that case, it's not a Makat Medina, and the loss goes to the Malamid. The loss is on the Malamid, they don't have to pay. However, he says, Achad Megdolim says that that's dafka kshemiut barcho, that's only when some of them run away. However, if everybody runs away, that's a Makat Medina, and the hefti is on the balabayit, and he has to pay, and the teacher gets paid. And that's how the Shach paskins. That seems to be the majority view. Now the Aruch HaShulchan adds and says, "V'li nire mistimat lashon Rabbi Rama. Da'afim havi makan medina. I have said aleim betamon na nireli dafka kishapohel o hamalamed omed muchan laasot melachto ela shehamalacha nitbatla." The Aruch HaShulchan comes up with a chiddush, and he says the reasoning for this is if the teacher is ready and prepared and willing to teach, it's just that he's prevented from doing so. He's done all the work that he needs to do. If they call him in, he's there. It's just that he's unable to do it because the government said no, because the students aren't coming to school, et cetera, et cetera. However, aval, im be'eti tabot ha-magefa barach ha-melamed v'gam ha-talmidim ha-hefsed shel ha-melamed. If the teachers ran away as well, if the teachers went for an early vacation as well, and they are unprepared to teach, then the Aruch HaShulchan says they don't get paid because they're not ready to teach.
This is about motivation. How are you supposed to judge that, especially when you're doing something across the nation? Or is it really going to be upheld in court where you just ask, are you ready to do it? Okay, come in. Is it one by one or?
Right. So that's actually a really interesting question. I didn't bring it in, but Rabbi Student quotes Rav Toledano, who's a grandson of Rav Adya Yosef. I'll show this to you. He has it inside. He quotes this amazing tshuva about during the war. I'm not sure. I have to look up which war it is. Let's see if we can find it right now. The actual PDF over here. Here. The Meshiv Mishpat. He says, Tashlum schar melamdim upoalim. And he says, what's the deal with melamdim, gananot, and people who are doing melachet kodesh? Shemachmat ha-milchama hanal nitbatlu mi-melacham v'lohim shichu ba-avodatam. That they can't continue to work because of the war. Nobody's going to school during the war for 3 weeks. Do we have to pay them? And he says an amazing thing. He says, let's see if I can find it. Here, we'll look at it in where my student quoted. I can't find it in the Hebrew. Take a look. He says, if a teacher knows that he would not have taught during the war due to fear, he cannot ask for his salary in good faith. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. It sounds almost like the honor system. However, if he believes that he would have taught if school was in session, then he was already paid, he can keep his full salary.
You know, it's not necessarily the honor system. I'm thinking of something like Chernobyl, where the entire city was evacuated. Right. And even if a teacher would say, hey, I would have wanted to teach if I could, but hey, the entire city was evacuated. What am I supposed to do?
So
and
I
that's
mean,
not an honor system.
It sounds like the, but it sounds like the Aruch HaShulchan is saying that once the teacher runs away, that's it. He's not eligible to be paid anymore because he's not prepared to work.
So even if he's forced away, he's not just running away. In the example of Chernobyl, for example, he's forced away.
It would seem. What do you think?
Since you have someone saying, "I would be afraid,"
right?
You're actually leaving it to them, but not that they're willing. There's two different levels. One is, I'm willing to work. I was ready to work if it happened. Is that in a natural state of affairs, or is I'm willing to work even in this catastrophe state of affairs?
I think even in this catastrophe state of affairs. If you can't say that, if you can't say that, then you can't be paid.
Okay, I get it.
That's what it seems to be saying. Mm-hmm. That's what the Aruch HaShulchan seems to be saying. If they ran away, although maybe you could be medayik that he says b'hatchalata ones. Not sure if you can be medayik. Like, what happens if the students ran away and then the teacher said, "Well, there's no students, so we might as well go on vacation"? Does that mean that they just forfeited their salary because they also left? It sounds almost from here like, no, in that case, they could still get their salary because they were willing to stick around. It was the students who ran away first. Maybe we can be dyke that way. Because the whole reason why the balabait is going to lose is because, and this is a quirk in this whole halakha, this is where it becomes a little bit more, harder to grasp, is that the argument is, Mishmayahu de Gazrale, that we almost say, listen, it's Hashem's who arranged it this way that you're going to lose your money. In other words, it's almost like it's not pure dumb luck that you that this happened to you, but it was arranged that it should happen this way, and Hashem is arranging it to benefit the worker, benefit the teacher. Now, this is all. The problem is that this is all machloket, right? This is all debatable. And so it's very likely that in most cases, you could just say, Hamotzi mechaver olav araya. Anybody can just say, well, I can paskin like the Sma, or I can paskin like the Rama, or I can paskin like the Maram Mirotenberg. And therefore, it's very hard to extract money from somebody if they decide that they're going to paskin like that. The reality is that at the moment, in most cases, the gananot, the teachers, the schools, the systems, they've already been paid. That's just the way that business is done nowadays in the school system, right? I gave checks all the way at the beginning of the year, probably for this very reason. I gave 12 checks at the beginning of the year. In order to get out of it, I have to cancel the checks, which anybody who's ever canceled a check in Israel knows is just not worth the headache. You're just better off paying. In this case, Amotzi Mechaver Alav Araya, there's definitely halachic questions about whether or not I've paid if I wrote a check. But the reality is that it's a lot harder to get my money back once I've written the check. So in most cases, it seems that the money stays in the hands of the school.
If you might make a case that writing a post-dated check means you haven't paid for it, really.
You could easily make an argument.
You're paying as of next May, for example.
You could easily make an argument like that. You could easily make an argument like that. But speaking as somebody who did once cancel a check, it's just not – you might as well have paid. It's that bad to cancel a check.
Well, it depends on the amount of the check.
Your chance of winning an argument when you cancel a check is very low.
If the check is for 100,000 shekel, it might pay to go through hoops for this. If the check is for 200 shekel, maybe.
In this specific case, we have to call Michal Afer or a lawyer. My guess is you would lose the case if you canceled the check. In this specific case, in most cases. Here's other arguments in terms of not the total canceling of school, but at least what happens when there's distance learning. Because when I paid my tuition at the beginning of the year, I was paying for in-house learning. I wasn't paying for distance learning. So should I be able to claim that back? So this is actually from the Vada Rabbanim of Queens. So they came out with a psak where they said that salaried school employees whose job is related to educating the children, if they continue their educational job, such as providing classes via Zoom during the time the school premises are closed, are to be paid in full. If a school does not provide these services, the schools and teachers should meet to determine if any salary should be paid to the teachers, and if they cannot come to a mutual agreement, they may turn to the Beis Din for further instruction. They're basically saying, you know, we haven't figured that part out yet. But if they do any distance learning, then they should be paid in full. And Rabbi Student says that he corresponded with Rav Shlomo Aviner, and he said the same thing, that as long as they're doing distance learning, they're doing whatever they can, then they are actually, you know, they should be paid as salaried employees. Another point to be made over here is Rav Schachter. Herschel Schachter has been coming out with, they called it coronavirus psakim. There was a period where over a course of like 2 months, he was coming out with one almost every week, with like three every week. On different issues, they weren't exclusively about coronavirus. They're all about all kinds of different issues, but most of them were about coronavirus. Just making it a little smaller so I can get it on the page. And in particular, he talked about this issue, amongst other things. Here he's talking about basically saying, you know, what should people do about Yizkor? And he says, anybody can say Yizkor at home. That's the only davening thing I'm going to mention. People could say Yizkor at home. And he says, what about paying the schools? What about paying for Pesach programs? This is another issue, he said. Do I have to pay for a Pesach program that I signed up for that got canceled if I already paid? So actually, he says, let's say you didn't yet pay. Let's say you were planning on paying for a Pesach program. Look what he says. Kol elu shayim muchanim lehotzi alafim urevavot amanat shekol mishpachtam yu be'eza malon al Pesach. Whatever money you were going to spend on the hotel, you should give it to tzedakah. And he continues, here he says down here, Hu adin b'nidon didan, b'ele shemenahalim tochniot miyuchadot milonim Pesach. What about the people who arrange these programs for Pesach? So if they've already been paid, but the Pesach program is not happening, so nobody's getting any benefit from the Pesach program. So should you get your money back? So he says, "Achuz mesuyam mehatashlumin shemekablim ze avur tirchatam upeulatam." A certain percentage of that money is not, you know, is not for the gear that they're going to buy or the trip that they have to pay for, but it's for the work that they're doing to plan and to arrange. Umiktat avur haochlin v'avur hishtamshut b'malon, and some of it is for, you know, using the hotel. So he says, you should figure out how much is for the tircha, how much is for the work that they're doing, and how much is for the expenses. And then that's going to be the basis of what they should give back to the guests that aren't coming. You should give back to the guests the expenses, the stuff that's not actually going to be used. Amishtatvim shalon enem miklum. Ubavadei yafsidu menalei tachniot hefzed gadol. Of course, there's going to be a big loss. Gikvar shalmu hon rav. They, of course, spent their own money on this, and they didn't get anything out of it. You have to figure out how much maybe they're going to get paid back for. But then he says, and even if it comes out that these people have to give back a large amount of money to the, you know, to the guests, he says, you know what? Gimel simanim yesh b'umazu. Jews have three signs. Rachmanim, baishanim, v'gomlei chasadim. We are merciful. We believe in tzniut, and we're gomlei chasadim. U'misha chaser lo mibidot elu, tzarech b'dika acharav, ulai eino yudi. And if you don't have these three traits, you have to check you out. Maybe you're not even Jewish. That's what the Gemara says. We're always told to go lifnim mishurat adim, to go above and beyond with anything that's ben adam l'chaviro. There's you know, numerous gemaras about this, specifically with regards to paying people. It's a famous gemara about a certain amora who paid a group of workers to do something and they didn't do it. Not that there was a disaster, they just didn't do it. Or they did a very bad job. And this Amara was told, you have to pay them full and you have to pay them for the meals. Even and the guy says, but they didn't do anything. He says, doesn't matter. You have to go lifnei mishurat hadin. I ain't sham. You can look up the Gemara at some point. So he says, kedai lekayem mitzvat tzedakah b'balei chov shalanu. We should, you know, if you can, basically Rav Shachter is saying, if you can afford to pay them, you should pay them. If people did hard work, they're going to lose a lot of money. You were willing to pay for your program. You didn't get to go on the program. Understood. You should, but if you can afford to, you should pay them. That's his psak for that. And then he gets to our issue. I heard that there are parents that have started to ask schools to pay them back for the tuition. Rav Shachter says, it cannot be that people think that they can do this. Because the schools can't even pay the salary of the teachers. They don't have enough money. We're going to have to close the yeshivas if we do this. Right now. He says, if we do this, there aren't going to be any yeshivas when we want to open back up. He says, you have to support the yeshivas and the teachers have to be paid. So if Shechter sees this from a public policy, communal perspective of supporting yeshivas. Yes, Dad.
It sounds like a very specific psak he's giving here. But if I want to generalize it for yeshivas, let me generalize it a little bit. If I pay for my gym membership and the gyms are closed by the government for 2 months, Rabbi Shachter isn't addressing that same kind of a thing.
Certainly not from the perspective of communal need. Like nobody's going to say, Shachter wouldn't say, you know, listen, if you don't pay the gyms, there aren't going to be any gyms when we finish this. It's not gonna hold any water. You're right. You're totally right. Okay. So that's in terms of that. Let's go on to some other issues. Yeah. All right. Here's some smaller, more just lower stakes, I guess. So Rav Asher Weiss was asked. The rest of them are going to come from Rav Asher Weiss mostly. Rav Asher Weiss was asked by a doctor. He says, "Let's say you see somebody who was sick with corona, and assuming that he was significantly sick, and you see him afterwards, and the whole time he was in bidud, so you didn't know what the story was with him. So when he gets out, you're very happy to see him. Hayim yivarech shechianu o mechaye metim. Can you make the bracha that you say when you see somebody after a long time, when you thought you weren't sure if they were going to survive?" And he said, you know, all these kinds of questions of making a bracha like this. So Rav Asher Weiss gives an interesting answer. He says, I'm going to answer you what I've been answering with these kinds of questions for many, many years. He says, we have a whole class. I'll summarize what he says. We have a whole class of brachot called brachot brachat re'iyah or brachat ro'eh, where if you see certain things, so you make a bracha. So, you know, everybody knows about the ones where if you see the Yam HaGadol, so you make a bracha on the Yam HaGadol. If you see a rainbow, you make a bracha on the rainbow. If you see lightning, you say a bracha on the lightning. But there's things about when you see people or things also that you make a bracha. There's the weird ones. If you see a very strange object, so you say Mishan HaBriot. If you see a beautiful object, you say something else. There's also
there's a bracha for seeing a king, right?
Yafeh. So there's a bracha for seeing a king, and there's a lot of debate about that. There's also a bracha for seeing a Talmid Chacham. A great Talmud Chacham, a gadol ador. So Rav Asher Weiss says, about things like this, he says, I always give the same answer. Basically, he says, Sheva al Tasa. Better not to say it. Why? He says, because you can only cause problems with this. He says, for example, I still remember this from my time in yeshiva. Rav Ari Marcus, our Rosh Yeshiva, was giving halacha shir, and he was talking about exactly this issue. And he was saying, you know, there's a bracha that you make on a gadol hador. And so, of course, inevitably, the kids started raising their hand. Who's considered a gadol hador? And the kids started asking, you know, what about this person, that person? And Rabbi was like, okay, I think you make a bracha on him, but I'm not sure if you make a bracha on him. And I was like, are the apples? Like, how do you make a bracha on him, but not on him? And Rav Asher Weiss says, we should avoid this. Maybe a long time ago, it was obvious. If you saw Rav Chaim Hozer Grzesinski, if you saw the Chassam Sofer, everybody knows these people go in Olam, the people who are recognized by the entire world. There weren't so many. Make a bracha on these people. But nowadays, if you're a Baba Ver Chassid and you see the Ger Rebbe, do you make the bracha? If you're Svardi, right, and you see, I don't know, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, or if you're Ashkenazi and you see Rav Yitzhak Yosef, like, it gets all complicated, and the only thing you can do is really insult people or insult Kavod Torah. So he says, better you should give respect to Talmid Chachamim and don't make the bracha. So he says, so too here. What happens if you know that you had two friends in Bidud and you run into them on the street, and the first one you see is a really, really good old friend, and you say, oh, I heard you were in Bidud, now you got out, and you make a bracha, Baruch Mechayim Eitim. And then the other friend comes from the other side, and this friend, you know, you're not so close to him. You're not so happy to see him, which is the deciding factor for making this bracha or not. Not so crazy about seeing him. So maybe you don't make the bracha because you feel like it'll be a bracha levatala. He says, what have you done? You know, you've insulted him. So Rav Asher White says, better sheva al taseh, don't make this bracha. You should say, Baruch Hashem, it's so nice to see you. It's wonderful. I'm glad that you're better. We could say some tehillim and make a seuda, but better not to make the bracha. That's his conclusion. Okay, so that's one answer. Here's another one. This is a longer one. They started making it a rule that when you go into closed places, stores, malls, et cetera, they take your temperature. So they do the same thing in hospital nowadays. If you want to go into a hospital, they take your temperature. So Rav Asher Weiss was asked, what happens if I wanted to go into a hospital on Shabbos? So apparently there was installed in some places where you don't have to have somebody come over to you and shoot you in the head with one of those thermometers, but rather there's some kind of ma'arechet automatit. Some where you, I guess it's almost like a metal detector. I haven't been to hospital this whole time, so I don't know. Does anybody know? Is there some kind of machine that measures you as you come into the building? Has anybody seen this?
I was in a Sutta in Tel Aviv last week, and they did not have that.
Did somebody shoot you in the head on the way in?
Not on the way in. When I went upstairs to see the secretary, they shot me in the head.
So
about an hour later.
I drove in on Shabbat, and as I was parking my car in the shul before Musaf, they gave me that. You know.
Very funny. So it sounds like there's some kind of like a metal detector type of thing where it checks you automatically, because it doesn't sound like he's talking about a case where they do it manually. So he says, can you go into a hospital to be mevaker cholim? Obviously, if you're sick, this is not a question. This is a question of being mevaker cholim in the hospital when you know that you're going to be measured by this machine. So Rav Asher Weiss says, the person asking says, it happens to be that Rav Asher Weiss has a very unique position on electricity. It has...
Even if it's being... if it's an automatic thing, then you're not activating it. And you just walk past and it does it anyway, then you've got no say if it's being done or not. You've got no control over it.
Right. So that's
like
going to be...
It's not one of those lights that you walk past on the street and it activates it. You walk past on the street, so you make sure you go further into the street so it doesn't activate it. Here, it's being activated anyway.
Good. So that's pretty much the Ikar point over here, where he says... Look, Rav Asher Weiss has, you know, a very strident viewpoint on electric devices on Shabbos, where he says that, you know, when it's aser midaraisa, which is a unique viewpoint close to the Chazon Ish and far from Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and the way that we usually paskin. He has some chidushim over there, which we've discussed in other forums. But on the other hand, he has his kulas because he says that, and Uri is kind of referencing this, that if it's completely unintentional, an unintentional usage of electricity is basically completely mutar. It has to be a melechet machshevet in order to be a violation of Shabbat, which means it has to be intentional and creative. And so he says, in this case, where you're walking through the metal detector, or it's not a metal detector, the thermometer, I don't know, the automatic thermometer, he said, and Uri, this is even if you're activating. I think he's assuming that you activate it as you walk through. It's not running the whole time. I assume that's what's going on. Even if you activate it, you're not intentionally activating it. You're just walking, and then it's happening to you. And so he actually uses a few arguments to say that it's mutar. One argument that he says is, like I just said, that it's actually more similar to the cameras in the old city, and in many places basically nowadays, cameras that take pictures of you as you're walking through. So he says everybody, not everybody agrees, but he thinks that it's completely mutar to walk around in the old city when there are cameras, because nobody's thinking about the cameras when they're walking around. It's completely unconscious. But he also adds on a few other snifim lahakel. He says, number one, that it's a shat hadchak, and therefore we can rely on those that think it's only asur midarabanan anyways. So that will bring it down a notch completely. And then he says, number three, that it may be a psikresha delo nichale. And even though we're normally machmir on a psikresha delo nichale, in this case, extenuating circumstances, we can be makel. What's a psikresha delo nichale? It's a situation where you're doing something which is not a malacha, but will inevitably result in malacha. So let's assume that this measurement is a malacha. However, you have no interest or even anti-interest in the actual malacha that's happening. And so he says over here, the person who's being measured, he doesn't want to be measured, and he doesn't really, you know, is not asking to be measured. And therefore, it's going to be a malacha, it's going to be a psikresh de la nichale. And he says, nevertheless, he does end up saying that if it's not for a real purpose, he says, if you just stop visiting the hospital because you want to be mevaker and misameach, he says better not to go, because it's better to avoid it. However, if there's a torah, you're visiting someone specific who it's very important that you see them, then it's okay to go. So his psak is that it's okay to go and to go through the metal detector. Not metal detector, the thermometer thing. The last thing that I wanted to do, I don't think we have time for it. I'm just going to tell you what he talks about. It's a part of a set of painful tshuvas over here, where he says, what is the level of achrayut on people to prevent, if they know that they have corona, to prevent other people from getting it from them? In other words, let's say I imagine I have corona, Rahman al-Islam. So to what degree halachically am I obligated to prevent other people from getting it from me? How careful do I have to be? And it's important to analyze it from a halachic perspective, which is what he does. And then in a different tshuva, he writes back to somebody who wrote to him that he knows that he accidentally infected somebody and that person died. And he writes to Rav Asher, this person writes to Rav Asher Weiss asking what he should do for tshuva, what's the right thing for him to think about, you know, how should he approach this, is it his fault, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Rav Asher Weiss writes with a broken heart what he thinks about it, that it is his fault and that, you know, he has to do tshuva, and all different kinds of cases like this. But, you know, it's 10 o'clock and that's going to be my call to stop. So if we want to, we can continue this next time, or maybe we can go on to something else, although I think we're going to be taking a break for the summer soon enough. Anybody has any ideas, let me know.
Shkoyach.
Shkoyach.
You wanted to talk to me, I'm still on.